It's time for Knox Talk, a behind-the-scenes look at the business side of college sports, featuring Paul Sickman from Knox Sports and Brandon Parks from the Vol Network. Now for today's show.
And welcome to another edition of Knox Talk. Today is Wednesday, the 17th of April, and I am joined, as always, by my good friend Brandon Parks. Good morning, buddy.
Hey, good morning, Paul. Spring is here, and our two baseball programs are on fire right now, so let's keep it going.
I love it. Let's go one more month, get to the regionals, and not play each other.
Exactly.
We are joined in our second part today of our discussion on comparing selling sponsorships in college and pro, and we're here with Sara Barnes. Sara is the Senior Director of Corporate Partnership Sales with the Detroit Pistons. And Brandon promised that he's going to have questions. I have questions. So we're going to dive right in and have no prelude so we can take advantage of all the time we have. So, Sara, my first question, when you think about gifts, when you think about giving things from a hospitality perspective to your corporate clients, when you look at that, do you look at that as a part of the budget? Is that a percentage of sponsorship? And the reason I say this, because in Brandon's world, in Learfield's world, and a lot of the resellers around the country, they have a very specific percentage of the budget within a corporate sponsorship deal that they are only allowed to allocate to those types of things. So I want to just kind of circle back with you and find out, so when you look at yours in a pro environment, is that just an overarching budget, or how do you manage that piece of it?
Yeah, I mean, for us, it's a little bit different based on who's a current partner versus who's a prospective partner, right? I think that that's just a typical strategy, right? When you look at who you're already doing business with. We do have budgets set for both, but I will tell you, Brandon, it's a little bit at our discretion based on the status of the relationship, where we're at with the renewal, what might be needed. I think that at all times we have to show a business case if we're doing something that's over and above kind of standard practice. Typically you do look at deal size and investment and what's the asset mix, and you have a bit of that that you have, or at least gives you some flexibility to have really strong and build strong relationships with your partners. Cause, we really find that gift giving that is, intentional and authentic and builds a connection is very, very, very important. We do also do quite a bit of kind of having gifts on hand. So while we do some custom gifting, you know, for example, every so often when we're trying to get in front of a new brand, like we'll send them a custom jersey, right? Or something like that, right? But for us, we also have a whole inventory of things that we can always go to. We're fortunate to have a partnership with Isaiah Thomas's champagne brand called Sherline, where every year we get, you know, 50 bottles of champagne that are signed by Isaiah Thomas that we can kind of use at our discretion. We do have to request for those and state the business case, but, you know, it's a combination of things that we have on hand as well as budget that we can go above and beyond for as needed.
But let me extend one piece there. So from a ticketing perspective, a suite perspective, really kind of the biggest difference though, Sara, is that you don't have to ask permission to do tickets for a game or to do maybe some suite tickets or those kinds of things. Whereas in the college environment, they may need to go to the school and actually pay for the seats or pay for the suite or pay for those. You have that in your kind of your hip pocket because of who you are. And that's a huge difference in terms of the advantage you might have because you can just reach there and do it.
Yeah, for us, at least it changes year to year. We kind of monitor based on how the need was the year previous or the season previous to figure out, do we have the right amount of tickets? But we actually do technically purchase suites and seats that we have for every game. So it's a part of our budget where we have two suites, suite one and suite two, and then six club tickets. Those are used both to fulfill contractually obligated suite nights and club tickets. But then anything that's left over, we're able to use for hosting and hospitality or even giving as well. You know, typically we'll have a suite open at least one around the holidays when there's a partner that we could just say, hey guys, use the whole suite for you and your family. We do that as well. So we do have it in our budget. And then anything over and above is a special request that we ultimately get charged any sort of hard cost for, but don't necessarily have to pay for the face value of the ticket, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So on an annual basis, will you try to map out your gifting and then hospitality schedule? And if so, is there a certain number of touch points or frequency at which that you do a lot of this, what I call thank you type stuff?
Yeah, I mean, at a minimum, we will schedule out the hospitality when the schedule is released in August. Fortunately and unfortunately, there's good and bad parts to it, but the NBA is notoriously late for the schedule release, or at least the latest among the big four, because they always wait until after free agency to finalize what the NBA schedule looks like. So we typically get that in mid-August when the season starts in early to mid-October from a preseason standpoint. So at that time, we always map out what does the year look like? Do we need to make adjustments to our six club seats and two suite nights? Are there things that we know we're going to have to go above and beyond? If there's some big matchup, you know, a couple of years ago, for an example, our strategy was completely different when we knew we were playing in Paris and we had to create a whole strategy for taking our biggest partners to Paris with us. And how did that impact everything else that we did? So year to year, it definitely differs. So at a minimum, we do that. And then around the holidays, we always have our partner gifting kind of, you know, holiday gift schedule and strategy. We try to find something that's relevant to the season. So, you know, for the past couple of years, we've had some really unique jerseys, teal jersey, Bad Boys jersey. We've tried to incorporate that because it's real timely for our brand. But that differs as well year to year based on what we give. But the budget is ultimately the same, and we get budget approved kind of similar based on spend level, right? We have a tier one gift, tier two gift, tier three gift that we ultimately have to follow suit based on tenure and spend level of our partners.
So sticking with the kind of the hard cost, soft cost piece. So Sara, in the college world, again, this is kind of a change that's happened with Brandon, you know, as he's kind of evolved through all the companies that he's now been with, because it's been the same company, but it's been bought and then bought. And but that in that world, they have a hard cost and soft cost world, where there are pieces in there that they very much want to sell, signage, airtime, those kind of pieces that are all soft costs, wonderful profit margins for Learfield when they're going out and doing a deal. But a hard cost is something where they have to pay the school, a ticket, a suite. It could be a piece of merchandise, anything that they have to go out there and purchase. If you have a client that comes to you and says, "Hey, I want to do a $100,000 deal, and $75,000 of that is going to be tickets," are you okay with that? Or because it's just revenue, right? It's revenue to the Pistons, and you are internal for the Pistons. I assume you're okay with that, even though it may not be a lot of money for the marketing department per se. I would think that that's still okay in your world, right?
It is. I think that we take a closer eye on true hard costs versus ticketing versus sponsorship, right? We aren't paid on things that cost us money. So we are very mindful of that, obviously, from a sales perspective, where, hey, I've got a $100,000 deal. I'll still get paid. My team will still get paid on the $75,000. That may not count towards the sponsorship bucket, but there's still incentives to go ahead and get that deal done as long as it's a great deal for the organization, right? I think for
Right.
us, we're very mindful of less about how much is towards tickets, because you're right, it is ultimately coming to the same place. While it might be a different line item on the P&L, it's still revenue for the company. We're more mindful of, okay, you've got somebody who has hard costs with tickets. Let's say use the same example, $100,000 deal, $75,000 is tickets. If $25,000 remaining is all like appearance fees for Legends and hard costs for food and beverage, now we're starting to say, hey, does this ultimately still make sense for us at the ratio that is? Because we kind of look at deals that really all sorts of deals, but we say a deal is very healthy if it's 10% or less in true hard costs of the overall deal. So we want to be mindful of that as we're looking at hard versus soft costs, but don't necessarily consider tickets as a hard cost for us because it's ultimately still revenue for the company.
Yeah.
And sorry, in the college space, our model is really just so different because so many of the schools are represented by a third party that's outside of the athletics department. And our biggest single expense in running the business and generating the revenue is the expense that essentially goes back to the school in the form of the rights fee payment. And I think where we get really challenged in the college space is once you pay that rights fee or that revenue share, there's not a lot left in the bucket for any type of expenses. And then obviously trying to turn a profit for the company that we represent. I will say that just through the different models that I've seen in pro sports, I'm almost envious of how everything is under this one umbrella. And like you said, if while you're driving sponsorship, you run across someone that becomes a hospitality candidate that's interested in premium seating and skyboxes and those things, that you can roll those things up in agreements, and it's revenue towards the organization. For us, it becomes a pass-through expense directly to the athletics department. And that may be, in my years of doing this, the biggest difference between the pro sports model and the college sports model is just the ownership piece and how there's not a third party.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that sounds like it can be complicated. It's still something that I would say we, at the end of the day, the sponsorship team is incentivized and expected to drive sponsorship revenue. So at a minimum, we can relate, because it's not our focus to sell hospitality first deals. But as you said, if we come across it and there's a great relationship, we just want to get that done, because it ultimately still serves the company and the rep is still going to be paid commission on it. But similarly, but also different, I hinted at it earlier, but you know, for me, let's say I sell this $100,000 deal, $75,000 is tickets. Let's say the remaining is sponsorship net, signage, whatever it ultimately might account towards. As far as my individual goal, at least this is here with the Pistons, it differs team to team. I can only count the sponsorship revenue towards my individual goal. So while I still get compensated on the rest, my better and bigger bonuses are tied to the sponsorship revenue. So what we'll also see at times, Brandon, is we'll work very closely with our premium service team, because at the end of the day, just like we're experts in sponsorship, they're the experts in premium service and in seating. So they have a better view on available inventory, sort of why this seat versus that seat. While I did come up through ticket sales, and I might think I know what I'm talking about, there's people who live it and breathe it every single day, that at that time, if it's something where it really is mostly hospitality, there's a good chance that we get somebody on that side involved just to see out the play if the relationship doesn't matter. But it is a big difference between the two. I think that there's still priority on the sponsorship assets for the sponsorship team, though.
So, Sara, you don't have to give us rate cards, although we'd love it if you did. But outside of the jersey patch, which I know is priority number one for every NBA team, kind of go through with us the big ticket items that you have, maybe from most expensive to least expensive, and then talk about what has shifted. I'm going to prejudice the jury by saying I'm assuming that social media and radio are the two big leaders in that category of things that have shifted a lot in the last 8 years that you've been at the Pistons. So talk about, just go through with us, which might trigger some interesting things for a lot of our college sponsorship listeners, to what is the big ticket item for an NBA team, and then take it all the way down to the things that you just still maybe are less expensive that you put into a package.
So yeah, no question, our jersey patch partner is ultimately the most significant investment. I think you have to think about the Pistons as a little bit of a unique scenario, where many teams do fall suit with us, where we are a tenant at the building, not a building owner. So my answer will be a little bit different than somebody, I'll even use the Red Wings as a comparison, right? We have a joint venture with them. We do our concert business with them and kind of co-operate and own the different concert venues. But from a LCA, Little Caesars Arena perspective, they own it. We essentially rent it for the Pistons games that we play there and the events that we host there. So for the Pistons, yes, jersey, number one, as far as visibility, impact, all of the things that go along with it. But it's not just because of the jersey asset by itself. While that's tremendous value because you're a part of the uniform, you're on the uniform at retail for official team stores and team merchandise. You're on, whether or not it's a nationally televised game or a regional game, you're on all the player headshots. Every point where the player shows up, you're included from a patch standpoint. But typically the patch doesn't just have such tremendous value, or the package that the patch partners purchase don't just have tremendous value because of that 2x2 or 2.5x2.5 spot on a jersey. It's that plus having an apron logo on the court. You know, for the Pistons, that is probably our next guy up, or next asset up. When you look at the baseline apron being UWM right now, they're our jersey partner, or our sideline apron being Bet Rivers, which is one of our club entitlement partners. So as you can see, some of these high impact, highly visible TV visible assets are typically incorporated in these larger investment packages, because one, they drive up the value, because for us, we don't just sell the patch by itself. It's a patch asset included in a holistic partnership platform that ultimately, you know, differs partner to partner, brand to brand, depending on their objectives. But we typically incorporate at least one highly visible spot that's seen on broadcast. So I say TV visible. Obviously, there's so much in the air right now about linear versus streaming and all the things that go on from a TV standpoint. But having placement on physical placement on the court gives you the ability to be seen, obviously, in arena, on social, everything in between. Sometimes you get those SportsCenter top 10 moments, or not top 10, depending on what goes on, where all of a sudden, you know, that logo is showing up there too. And that's way more visible than the patch, right? So you've got to think about
it. So do you leak in the middle of the season and say, listen, I need you guys to give up a whole bunch of really amazing dunks here the next couple of weeks, because we need to be on TV. Yeah. If you're not going to win, let us just get posterized a couple of times so ESPN will pick us up. Does that come up?
You know, we have made a lot of lemonade this last year, as I like to tell people, that, hey, we had the historic NBA losing streak this fall, right? From November through December. We had no win November or whatever people were saying, right? And as unfortunate as that was, the amount of value that we drove specifically for some partners that were on the court because of all the pickups that were happening on social, on TV, and everything else, it was a bit of a silver lining to the story. So the performance numbers are actually really great. As far as where we showed up, now you can argue that, is the story the right story? Sure, I can see that perspective. But I think the interesting part is that fans are still tuned in, and fans are, they still have an affinity for our brand, and they still want to see us do well, might be having some jokes and some things like that. But kind of going back to the assets, you know, think about those for people who don't own the buildings. And to be specific on that, you know, we play in a building where our official vehicle of the Pistons is Kia, but there is a Chevrolet entrance, who is the official vehicle of the arena, right? So we have to find kind of some sandboxes to play in. But I use that as an example for an investment, because arguably Chevrolet is spending more than Kia because they have this big entitlement entrance, right? So you have to think about it as physical assets for people that own their buildings, as opposed to someone like me who has to get creative with some physical assets. But also we try to think about, how do you create a partnership that is more platform-based? You know, I'll use an example of our Shop 313, our small business initiative that ended up winning Partnership of the Year the first year that it was launched and that we ran it. That was a significant investment from the partners that participated, because it was such a holistic story where it incorporated a lot of traditional assets, TV visible signage, community assets, things like that. But ultimately, we created something that was worth seven figures that didn't necessarily use things like a club entitlement. So I think the answer goes, yes, there's a very specific what the rate card says, but sort of you have to weave that into what our strategy is to drive revenue using some of those assets, where we incorporate some of those into a larger package to ultimately drive a larger number and better value for the partner. If that makes sense.
Sure. So now go down to the other direction. Like we talked about, there's probably some things that have shifted a bunch, right? That over your time. I mean, I remember when, I imagine 8 years ago, I know Brandon and I were selling radio, you know, we're buying radio and selling radio, and radio had a probably more of an importance than it does now. And social media was almost non-existent a decade ago. And now in a lot of college settings, that is the number one rate card piece they have on their file, is a social media campaign. Is that the same with y'all?
Yeah, I would say it's a very important piece. I would say that it continues to evolve too, where even 8 years ago, call it when I started, you saw a lot of emphasis on, you know, logo inclusion on content. Now it's less about the logo inclusion. It's more about, how are we telling a great story through this content and having the brand show up in a meaningful way. I think the interesting thing as well is there are some restrictions from a league standpoint that continue to show up as it relates to the CBA, where we can't just do a logo slap. We have to be really intentional about what are we doing on social that tells the story that we want to tell, right? You know, as an example, you guys can even take a look at the, you probably can't see it anymore, but we've had to update a lot of our social graphics this year, because no longer can you just do a logo on, you know, a Pistons win graphic. You have to do this Pistons score update presented by Wingstop, right? So it's unique how some of the rules change year to year, and how we have to adapt to make sure our partners still show up and that their logo isn't necessarily sacrificed as far as size and scope goes. Radio, I'll be honest, is definitely a little bit of a afterthought. The numbers kind of show itself where some markets crush it with radio. You know, I've seen across the NBA where it's more of a demographic thing, where if they've got a lot of fans, where that's their primary way of consuming the game, then they still are doing well. But for Detroit, it just hasn't necessarily been our number one driver of value, because at the end of the day, the numbers kind of speak for themselves. I think we continue to see a lot of changes too, like I mentioned previously, on broadcast. I think that that will be the next big change, is how people are just consuming games in general, whether that's in the future with AI and how do you personalize the at-home viewing experience? How do you consume it? Is it all streaming? Is it local TV? You've seen a couple of teams, you know, Phoenix, Utah, where they've just made their games readily available on local cable, right? You don't necessarily need a big expanded cable package to consume their games. You know, I think that I tell people all the time that the most constant part about this industry is change and adaptability, because it's not just the change of, you know, the court performance or whatever, but the assets change quite a bit as far as their value and how we position them and how we use them, because technology changes, right? The way we're consuming games changes, customer behavior changes. Going back to social, like I was saying earlier, I feel like a lot of what our strategy was okay, we've got these 10 different content series, you know, Hooper's World and Pittston's Playback and things like that, where it's like, we're gonna do these content pieces and we're gonna put a brand on it. Now it's okay, how are we gonna leverage the content we have? Use paid social, maybe pick and choose which platforms it's showing up on based on the hope and reach of the demographic, or the demographics of the audience that the brand is trying to reach, and ultimately put a little bit more strategy behind it, where it's not just putting a logo on content, if that makes sense. It's just so much
Absolutely.
more strategic and intentional, and it has to be, because if you're not being intentional and proficient with this type of social and digital content, brands are asking those questions. Brands want to know the specifics. Brands want to make sure that they're not just getting a logo slap either. So I think that will just continue to evolve, especially with technology, AI, and all the things that continue to show up in our industry.
Sorry, talking about new business, which we all really, if there's one pressure that we all feel is how we incrementally grow the business, and a lot of that is with current partners, but then you also have new partners. What are some of the most effective ways that you have seen to reach out to prospective businesses and effectively get a foot in the door to be able to have a conversation?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I wish there was a one size fits all answer. I think that is
Sure.
the answer, though, is that you can't take the same approach with everybody. I think it has to be diversified as far as the way you're reaching out, right? So, of course, send the email. Of course, send the LinkedIn connection. Of course, have a cold call. If you have their phone number, I can reach them. You know, all the things that might ultimately be the traditional things that we're doing. But we have so much information just readily available at our fingertips that, you know, it's not the best term ever, but we joke and we say, like, what are we doing from like a social stalking standpoint? Like, how are we seeing them online? If I can do a quick search of Paul Sickman and see that he's a family man, has some kids, like, can I send some swag to Paul's office that isn't just for him, but it's for his kids too, right? Just things where it's not, don't go too crazy. Don't do too, so much research that it's like, whoa, how do you know all this about me? But enough that it's like readily available. You know, or as an example, are there
Is
the
that a pod,
main
is that a podcast, Brandon? Social stalking?
there you go.
That's a multi-year
I could
series.
dive way into that and talk all the things that, you know, are good and can work really well. But specifically, I would encourage folks, especially from a university standpoint, like, we really take a look at, okay, what teams did our guys play for? Let's prospect from those teams. Who are Purdue alumni that might want to get a Jaden Ivey Pistons jersey because he was a superstar there, right? So I think that we're really intentional with finding a connection point and a reason to reach out and a reason to have a conversation, and individualizing our efforts so it doesn't feel like a blanket approach to everybody. Hey, I saw you on a billboard today driving into work. Obviously, Detroit matters. Let's have a conversation to see how the Pistons could add value to your marketing mix, right? Things like that. So I think going back to sort of that social stalking, or finding out some more information online, it can be as simple as just, hey, instead of emailing them an invitation to a game, write them a handwritten note and invite them to the game and send your business card and say, I would love to meet. We're hosting at these games. We'd love to have you and a guest join us. At a minimum, you stand out. I think you just have to think about, you know, for me, I tell my team all the time, you're one of four pro teams in Detroit. As we've talked about previously, you're arguably one of six, if you include Michigan and Michigan State. Then you're one of 30 NBA teams. You multiply that for NHL, NFL, MLB, MLS, even though we don't have an MLS team here. These brands, especially national brands, who may or may not be interested in working with the Pistons at all, regardless, are being hit up by so many other people. How are you going to look and feel different? And I think that it's helpful to know a lot about the audience that you serve and using that as a way to reach out and find brands that would be interested in interacting with the audience that ultimately is yours. But also just finding unique connection points, whether personal, business, school they attended, family, you know, the list goes on for different ways that you can get in front of somebody, but just making it really genuine and showing that it's a person on the other side reaching out, that it isn't just a, hey, I sent out this email to 100 people. No, hey, it's Sarah. I want to have a conversation with you, regardless if the timing is right. An open line of communication to me is important. So I think it's a combination of being strategic, but also, you know, just slowing down and establishing these relationships with people to really get to know them, and then using that information to offer recommendations that you know you could ultimately help them out with.
So Sarah, category exclusivity is something that we obviously manage or try to manage on a daily basis in the college space, and exactly what that exclusivity looks like. Generally speaking, for your sponsorship division, how do you go to market and then address category exclusivities, and what options still may remain for other partners? Generally speaking, give us your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think it's a complicated answer because it very much differs based on category. We're very fortunate to have a ton of information at our fingertips, both from an internal data and analytics or business intelligence team, as well as what the league provides us based on averages based on category. So every quarter, we ultimately are ranked against the other 29 NBA teams and all sorts of things.
Wow.
They also, it's really incredible. Social, revenue, ticketing, attendance, all the things, but it kind of gives you a good check on kind of the health of the organization, where you're at, how you compare to like markets, which for us is probably most important. Because again, as I mentioned earlier, I could be compared to Cleveland, but Cleveland owns their building. So while our markets might be relatively similar, it's different because they can sell assets that I can't sell, right? So there's a very strategic kind of like market list. Some of them, I think you guys would actually be surprised for us. It's like Phoenix and Boston, which maybe don't feel like markets, but because they don't own their buildings, we do have a little bit of similarities in the business that we do. So with all that to be said, for us, we take a look at the comparison based on category. So the NBA has top 25, but they take a look at 100 plus categories where revenue is coming from with all different teams. It shows the average for the NBA. It shows the average for your like markets, that sort of what that category is worth, give or take. So that's really important because for us, when you come back to exclusivity, we take a look at, okay, of course, banking is going to be worth more than a law firm, right? And it's going to be more than even grocery, right? Local grocer. So you really kind of take a category specific approach to understand what are the averages, what historically have we done. And then we make a determination based off of that as far as what exclusivity is more or less valued at. You aren't just paying to be exclusive. Obviously, the exclusivity investment is a partnership package that just gets to that sum that ultimately provides exclusivity as a part of it. I think the interesting part is exclusivity can be very different based on level of spend and ultimate negotiation and agreements, where I'll use Allegiant Air as an example with us. They're our official airline partner. They have some exclusivity with some of their competitors, but they also don't necessarily compete with somebody like at least not at this point, they will in the future, but somebody like a Delta who does business travel, right? You look at Detroit being a Delta hub, we could still do a deal with Delta as long as we're mindful of the swimming lanes and all of the things. But it gives us an opportunity to make Allegiant feel really great about their investment and know that their direct competitors aren't going to come in, but doesn't necessarily close the category altogether because there could still be opportunity to drive significant revenue. So I think for us, it's how comfortable do we feel granting exclusivity in a category, knowing that we can't drive any incremental revenue? Is that number good enough for us for the foreseeable future? And the good enough for us is a very complicated re review of the sponsorship team, ownership, all of the people. But ultimately, we have a lot of resources that help us determine the numbers based on categories.
No kidding. That's a huge difference, Brandon. I mean, just the fact that she's got this data from around the country, I mean, that would be crazy. You guys would, if you didn't, weren't competing now across country with all the SEC and the ACC and the Big Ten schools, you'd be about killing each other if you had all that data every day.
Well, and
So
I think to be
Sarah.
clear, Paul, too, sorry to interrupt. I think
No.
that to be clear, it's not, we don't know who is who, right? It's very anonymous information. It still ranks the categories, but you don't necessarily know that the Boston Celtics are doing this in this category versus the Indiana Pacers. You just know that out of your like markets, the average of six like markets is this number, to be clear.
So what categories are you doing better than the average in? Were there a couple exclusivities that you guys are leading the pack?
Yeah, we have been crushing it in sports betting, casino, and mortgage lately, as far as comparison to the
Okay, money
NBA.
coming in and money going out. Great.
But very much so. Very much so. I think for us, it's also it changes year to year, right? You know, it's no secret that we're in a position where we're going to have a new patch partner next year. United Wholesale Mortgage is coming off of the patch because they bought the Phoenix Suns. It's been a great partnership. They're going to stay on as our partner, obviously, in some capacity, but that asset is now something that we're going to bring somebody new on, and that ultimately will probably make our mortgage category look a little bit different next year. So it differs year to year, but that's where we're at right now.
All right. Well, Sarah Barnes, thank you so much for spending so much time with Brandon and I. You'll probably never want to see the two of us again, other than the fact that you have to see me next week because we still have a deal to complete. Brandon, thank you for your time again. Folks, this was Knox Talk, and we appreciate every single one of you that listened and appreciate you guys downloading. We are growing every single week, and we appreciate that from all of you. So on behalf of Brandon Parks from the University of Tennessee, I'm Paul Signal with Knox Sports. Take care. See you again next time.